for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Few Supreme Court justices in modern times have achieved the name recognition of Antonin Scalia. He's famous for dogged questioning during oral arguments and for refusing to shy away from the spotlight. USA Today Supreme Court reporter Joan Biskupic has written a new biography of the popular to some, polarizing to others, justice. It's titled American Original. And Joan Biskupic joins me to talk about the life and constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. We do invite your comments, questions, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How good to see you.
Thank you, Diane.
Congratulations on this book. I know you've been working on it for a long time.
Thank you. The very first sit-down interview I had with this man was in 1990 when I was new in town as a reporter. And I've been watching him for many years, but I really started in earnest about 4 years ago after the Sandra Day O'Connor book. And it's been quite a trip. It was more challenging than the Sandra Day O'Connor book in some ways, because he's so darn polarizing, as you say, and a lot of tension and conflict around him. He doesn't have a linear story the way my prior subject did, but it's been it was both challenging and, I have to say, in the end, more rewarding, actually.
Interesting. How much time did he offer you?
Well, initially, Diane, there was no offer.
Right.
I sent him a note saying, I've got this contract, I'm doing this book. And he said, fine, but you won't be seeing me. Talk to my colleagues, talk to my family, talk to whoever you want, but not me. And I said, keep an open mind. Just keep an open mind. And in time, what I did was I had a lot of information on his family that he was not aware of. So I was sort of almost trading information, enticing him a little bit with my research to get him to talk. And in the end, Diane, we had about a dozen on-the-record interviews.
Wonderful.
Which, you know, really made the spine of this
book. Of course, of course. Talk about that information that you say you gleaned regarding his family.
Well, as you probably know from the book, his father came over here as a young teen from Sicily, knowing virtually no English, and went on to get a PhD in Romance languages at Columbia University. Was quite the striver. The justice grew up in a very quintessential first-generation Italian-American family. And, you know, going back through immigration records, going back through the father's story, I discovered things about him that I think intrigued the justice. In fact, the justice was an only child and also the only child of his generation in these two striving Italian-American families that he was in with his mother and father. And I found that the justice felt that he didn't quite measure up to his father's expectations, which is unusual for a young man who was first in his class in his high school in Manhattan, first in his class at Georgetown University, goes on to Harvard Law School. And one thing the justice said to me was that in 1986, when he was nominated by Ronald Reagan to the Supreme Court, it was a few months after both of his parents died.
Oh,
and he
I
said,
see.
He said that took some of the sweetness out of it.
Ah, I can only imagine, because the question is why, in his own mind, did he not measure up to his father's expectations?
Well, the justice's eldest son, Eugene, who actually is a lawyer in town, said his grandfather was the type who, when Nino, as he was called as a boy and is called now as an adult, would bring home an A, the father would say, well, couldn't you get an A+? Quite a striver, which is something I think we're all familiar with in first-generation families. And his father was the kind of man who always had his nose in a book, couldn't abide silliness. Unusually, though, the mother's side was much more the showman side. She was one of seven. She was the only one who produced a child. She was one of seven. They were more politicians, salesmen, more out there. And what I say about Justice Scalia is that he grew up in a household that had a lot of conflict and tension just in terms of the two families. And as a result, he became someone who was comfortable with conflict and tension and, frankly, readily generates it.
Did his mother encourage him where his father's expectations were almost beyond him?
His mother was the kind, he said, who always wanted to make sure he was with the right kids, did the right thing. She would help. She would be a Boy Scout troop leader to always sort of monitor this only child. Although he, early on, it sounded like he was quite fun-loving and a little bit at ease in his own world, confident as a young man, as he is certainly confident as a justice. So the mother was also demanding in her own way. She herself only finished high school, didn't go on to college, which would have been the era, of course. But among her siblings was the one, she was the eldest. And among her siblings, she was the striver, the one who was known for the good grades.
Joan Biskupic, she previously wrote a biography of Sandra Day O'Connor. Her new book is titled American Original: The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Your email to drshow@wamu.org. Remind us of why Ronald Reagan chose Antonin Scalia.
That's an excellent question, because at the time, in 1986, it looked like Robert Bork, then an appeals court judge in the District of Columbia, was poised for that seat. We're in 1986, and Ronald Reagan has won his second term. He had already appointed the first woman justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, in 1981. He has a Republican Senate, so he can basically get through anyone, or potentially anyone. And Reagan and his team of lawyers screening a lot of different individuals, looking very seriously at Robert Bork, who'd been around for many, many years, had been in both the Nixon and Ford administrations. And Scalia's there because then-Judge Scalia was on the D.C. Circuit, as was Robert Bork. Scalia was about a year later than Bork. Scalia was also 9 years younger. Scalia didn't have the reputation as the conservative firebrand as Robert Bork. But Antonin Scalia had the first-generation Italian-American story that appealed to Ronald Reagan. And also, a lot of Reagan's men thought that Scalia could be just as conservative, which he certainly turned out to be, but he also seemed healthier at the time. The Reagan folks didn't know whether he would get another appointment, as he then did in 1987 when Robert Bork was nominated. So it was Ronald Reagan wanted to change the federal courts. So he wanted someone who embodied his brand of conservatism. He wanted someone who was vigorous, certainly got it in Justice Scalia. And I think he liked the idea of someone who represented something larger than just the law. And here's a man who, as we know, lives large. Duck hunting with Dick Cheney, opera viewing with Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
He left a very lucrative law practice to take on the court.
What happened was in his early years as a lawyer, he worked in Cleveland for a law firm by the name of Jones Day, and had several other different partners at the time. And when he left that job, he didn't go straight into the bench. He first went into academia, and he left right before he was going to become a partner, or potentially could have become a partner, which gave up lots and lots of money, of course, for this growing family. He ended up with nine children.
Exactly.
But he didn't like private practice as much as he thought he'd like the world of academia, and he was certainly suited toward it. It was inspired by his own father, who taught for 30 years at Brooklyn College. He taught Romance languages. And I think he always thought he would become a professor permanently. But it turned out that he wanted more give and take, and he was drawn to the policy world of Washington, D.C.
How did he become such good friends with Dick Cheney?
Well, they knew each other from the Ford administration. Antonin Scalia was an assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel during the Gerald Ford years. And Dick Cheney held various jobs and became chief of staff. And Justice Scalia told me that they weren't very super good friends, but they were friendly. And he said he knew I was on the right team. They both very much believe in executive power. They cut their teeth in Washington at a time of post-Watergate tension with Congress, certainly. So they, I would never describe them as best friends, but certainly they're friendly enough to go duck hunting together.
And how did that friendship proceed? Did they begin to share ideas, ideals, and share political views?
I think they definitely did share political views. In fact, they both worked very hard to try to get then-President Ford to veto amendments to the Freedom of Information Act, for example. Now, again, remember what this is like, 1974-75. Watergate has imploded. The Ford administration is saying it wants to be more public. It's saying it wants to deal more with Congress. But you have folks like then Assistant Attorney General Scalia, then Chief of Staff Cheney, who feel like they still need to have a pretty high barrier around the executive. And they're not the prevalent voices at the time. You know, there's a lot of pressure from Congress to be more open, especially in the wake of Watergate. So they certainly shared a kind of mentality about executive power relative to Congress. And I say at one point that it was an era in which some people started developing much more of an us versus them mentality, which I think we've seen embodied in folks such as former Vice President Dick Cheney. And then I think Justice Scalia has a little bit of too.
He, you think, continues with that us versus them?
He, in various ways. In fact, he still, even as a man who was educated at Harvard Law School, certainly entitled to lots of legal privileges, will refer to the legal elite sometimes as the enemy.
Joan Biskupic, her new biography is titled American Original. If you've just joined us, Joan Biskupic is with me. She is the court reporter for USA Today. She's previously written a biography of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Her new book is all about Antonin Scalia, whom Joan Biskupic titles American Original. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Joan, I think in my heart I knew it, but to read it in print that Justice Scalia believes that judges should render constitutional decisions based on 18th century understanding of the text. It's a fight worth making, he has said. I'm really taken aback by that.
The prevalent view in America among most judges, I'd have to say, is that, no, you don't go with this originalism approach. You look more at the Constitution as a document that can be applied more to society's
needs
today.
A living document.
Exactly. In fact, that phrase was embodied by in the jurisprudence of the late William Brennan, justice on the Supreme Court, who left in 1990. And currently, Justice Stephen Breyer writes and talks a lot about that counter approach. But what Justice Scalia says is that you look back at what the drafters of the Constitution wanted, how they understood their times, and if you feel, as a judge, as a policymaker, whatever, that the Constitution is not able to address societal needs today, pass a law. Don't leave it to appointed judges. Leave it to elected officials to do this. So it's a matter of his saying it doesn't always yield the right answer in terms of what might be necessary in America, but it's the proper answer given the role of the judiciary. And it's a controversial point of view. It's a view that probably it will never be the majority way, and people practice it. Justices practice it in different respects. Samuel Alito considers himself an originalist and doesn't come out the same way as Justice Scalia on a lot of things. So Justice Scalia and Justice Clarence Thomas, I would say, would be the strongest adherents of that very rigid 18th century view among everyone on the court right
and
now.
And for quite a while, Justice Scalia did vote always, or put it the other way, Clarence Thomas always voted with Justice Scalia. That's changed in recent years.
There's always been a little bit of a variation between them. What I like to say is they came on with their own individual points of view. Justice Scalia being much more of a dominant figure and Justice Thomas coming on with so much controversy during his 1991 confirmation hearing, it looked like to some critics of Justice Thomas particularly that he was just voting in lockstep with Justice Scalia. And I've talked with Clarence Thomas a lot about this, and what he says is, okay, we come out the same place on the law, but we're different. And certainly Justice Thomas, as a matter of fact, would reverse many more precedents than Justice Scalia. But I have to tell you something amusing about one of my conversations with Justice Thomas, who is quite sensitive on the point of are they in lockstep. He said, look, we might be the same on the law, but we're such different people. I'm the kind of person who goes home and wants to watch the Nebraska Cornhuskers on TV. Justice Scalia doesn't watch football on TV. Justice Scalia sits down before his computer, fires up some opera music, and acts like he's conducting a symphony. We are very different people. We don't socialize. We may end up on the law, but it's for different reasons.
Interesting. Here's an email from Alfredo in San Antonio. He says, when he, presumably Justice Scalia, when he did not recuse himself when the Cheney case came before the court, that was a disgrace and an affront to the court and the American people. Explain that case, Joan.
That the email comes from a listener who's recalling this case that Dick Cheney was at the center of. It had to do with the release of certain documents. And it came before the Supreme Court right at the time that Justice Scalia was socializing with Vice President
Duck hunting.
Duck hunting and some other activities right around the time. And Justice Scalia was asked to recuse, take himself out of the case by one of the parties to the case, the Sierra Club, which was challenging this non-disclosure of information from this energy task force that then Vice President Dick Cheney had headed. And Justice Scalia was so angry about the public outpouring of complaint and so angry that anyone would think that he couldn't be fair. And he wrote this long, I think it was a 23-page, angry statement saying, if you think I can be bought by a trip to Louisiana to go duck hunting with the president, the nation is in worse trouble than I thought. And he went on about all the times that people in the executive branch had socialized with justices of the Supreme Court. And he really missed in some ways the concern for that good old boy club that he was in some ways reinforcing. He did point out, he said, if I think I do have a conflict, I'll step down. And he actually did step down in a case involving the under God phrase in the Pledge of Allegiance that he had spoken about a year earlier. But this was one that I think overwhelming public opinion and news editorials all thought that for appearance's sake, he should not be in that case.
Weren't there other similar cases where he did not recuse himself and received a fair amount of criticism.
He did a little bit during Bush v. Gore because two of his sons were involved in law firms, one son more directly, the other son in a very preliminary way, with law firms that were on the side of then Texas Governor George Bush in his battle with then Vice President Al Gore over the Florida election dispute. So he had faced criticism on recusals before, certainly, but this was when it really came to a head, and he, to this day, just really digs in on it, and I think he felt that his own colleagues should have backed him up more, or that old pals and former law clerks should have backed him up more.
Putting the recusal itself aside, how much did he talk with you about Bush v. Gore?
Well, that was one of our topics of conversation, certainly over the dozen interviews with him, and he says to the American public, get over it. Just get over it. Stop asking me about this. It comes up still, Diane, when I go out to speak about him all the time. It comes up to him when he's talking. It comes up to me. You know, half the country still can't get over it, frankly. And he feels like he just takes too much criticism for that. But he was the one who wrote a statement on his own when they initially shut down the Florida recounts. As many of your listeners will remember, that dramatic time in December of 2000 when there was this tension between the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court over whether the recounts should continue in Florida. And it was Justice Scalia alone who wrote a statement for the American public that said, essentially, we're shutting down these recounts because we don't want to threaten the legitimacy of the likely winner, George W. Bush. And I think a lot of his critics believe that that was laying bare the politics of the moment. And no one signed that, even though it was a five-justice conservative majority that voted to shut down those recounts. It was Justice Scalia alone who wrote that statement.
Did you ask the same question of Sandra Day O'Connor?
Oh, Justice O'Connor did not want to talk about
exactly.
Bush v. Gore at all.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, was a sore spot with her for different reasons. Now, she was obviously on that majority vote. She's not as much identified with that case as Justice Scalia is, but it is one that I think will endure with her legacy and that she might feel a little more uncomfortable with, whereas my current subject is boldly in people's faces saying, we had to vote the way we did. Now just get over it, folks. She would never say that.
She has, as you know, been on this program many times and each time has said to me, now, Diane, I won't take questions about Bush v. Gore. It's just off the table.
Yeah. He would, there are times when he will not answer certain questions,
yeah.
But he would never do that. And frankly, since he has absolutely zero regrets about the role he played in that.
Zero regrets.
Yes. In fact, it's funny. Sometimes when I'm out speaking about him, people will say, do you think he regrets some of his decisions? No. I mean, mostly as a group, justices don't go around saying they regret
right.
things. But I don't think he, even in his heart of hearts, regrets past decisions. And one thing that's so different about Justice Scalia compared to my earlier subject is that he's been so consistent along the way. He has not evolved, so to speak. Justice O'Connor, as we all know, kept moving more and more to the left. And by the time she left the Supreme Court in January of 2006, she certainly was much more aligned with the liberal wing. I don't see that ever in the cards for Justice Scalia.
Talk about his positions on abortion and affirmative action.
I'll start with abortion because that's where he is so passionate. He has always felt that Roe versus Wade was an illegitimate decision. That's the 1973 ruling that made abortion legal nationwide. He called it a damned lie. He's argued against it at every turn. And I would say it's his most passionate cause as a justice against a certain precedent. You know, he's not out there urging the reversal of Brown v. Board of Education, for example, but Roe v. Wade really does just hit home with him.
Yes, his crawl.
Yes, yes. And I spent some time talking to him about how his religious views affect that, because, as you know, he's a very serious Roman Catholic and I have that chapter that you probably noticed called The Passions of His Mind. It was very difficult to write because what I did was I looked at these parallel passions, his Roman Catholicism and his interest in repudiating Roe versus Wade. And I present them as parallel passions, and I let him have his say about how one does not lead to another. But I also let critics have their say about how they believe he cannot help but be influenced by his Catholicism. Now, as a lot of your listeners will remember when he did that Sicilian chin flick thing in Boston where he flicked his fingers under his chin?
I do remember.
That actually happened when a reporter from the Boston Herald came up to him after a mass in Boston and said, what do you say to critics who claim that your religious views affect your ruling? And he said, this is what I say to them. And he does not care. He will accept questions about his religion, but he will also be very firm about, he says to me, I read texts. I'm an originalist. I'm bound by what the Constitution said, you know, from the 18th century, and my religious views or any other personal views do not go into the calculus.
So he simply feels that 1973 decision, Roe v. Wade, was wrong. It should be overturned. If he had the opportunity, he'd wipe it off the books.
Yes. In fact, he all along, this is another point where he's been incredibly consistent, as opposed to Sandra Day O'Connor or Anthony Kennedy, both of whom have varied their votes on abortion over the years. He, from the start, in his very first case in 1989 on abortion, just 3 years after he came on the court, very vigorously argued that it should be out the door.
Joan Biskupic of USA Today. Her new book is titled American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, Joan. There are lots of people who'd like to hear from you. Let's go first to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Andrew. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks so much for taking my
Certainly.
Call.
Certainly.
Thank you so much for all the work that you do. I love your show.
I'm so glad.
I'm really looking forward to reading this book, but my question to you is, has Justice Scalia read the book? And if he has he given you his opinion about it?
That's a good question. He skimmed through it enough to know that he could show up at one event celebrating the book. But as he was leaving that event, he said, I'll finish it and we'll talk. He also, I have to say, is so much in the market to promote his own book these days that there's no way he's going to try to elevate this one. He said to me, this caller from Miami would be interested to know, he said, now just tell me that your liberal New York editors didn't force you to put stuff in here you don't want. And I said, Justice Scalia, there's a lot in there you won't like, but I did it myself, and let me just tell you, get over it. So he will not like certain things. Yeah, he will not like certain things, but I have to say, and I love that you're from Miami, because when I did the Miami Book Festival recently, I got a lot of comments from liberals about, you know, was it hard to try to be objective and neutral toward this polarizing figure? And in some ways it was, but for a living, I always have to be more in the middle. You know, I have to accommodate various points of view as a reporter.
Of course.
So I felt that if he's got complaints, he'll have to live with them, because I really did try to go down the middle and not take cheap shots from either side.
Andrew, I'm glad you called. Let's go to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Joseph.
Thank you for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
By the way, you sound great.
Thank you.
So when Scalia's opinions are reported in the news, he often kind of justifies them with pragmatic reasons, like saying that you know, a certain decision might end up clogging the courts or put an undue burden on law enforcement or cause expense to companies or something. And I was wondering, Ms. Biskupic, in your interviews with him, did you get any sense of how he squares this kind of practical, pragmatic bent with his supposedly being a strict constructionist or an originalist when he puts so much weight on issues that don't have anything to do with the Constitution and aren't outlined there?
That's a good question, and let me just tell you where his practical side would come in. It really only comes in the narrower way of being concerned about whether the rule that the court is announcing is clear to lower courts. He's not pragmatic in the way that Justice O'Connor was, or that Justice Stephen Breyer, for example, is now, saying, you know, how will this play out in America? How will it affect many, many other people beyond the parties of the case? His view is that we as the Supreme Court need to offer a clear rule. No, I used to say he doesn't like, you know, shades of gray. He's a black and white sort of individual who says that lower courts need to know how to rule in subsequent cases. And if the Supreme Court majority doesn't do it, it just adds to more and more litigation, which is what the caller was referring to in terms of clogging the courts. He does not see that as inconsistent because he actually doesn't have the kind of sort of more down-to-earth, common-sense, pragmatic view of the law as working in a more integrated way with the other branches. He sees it as a separate mission in terms of what is truly in the text, what was truly in the understanding of the 18th century drafters.
How does he get along with his colleagues?
Well, that's a great question, because someone with that sort of fiery personality who's used to being the center of attention in some cases might not get along well. And he and Justice O'Connor would sometimes clash. Justice Harry Blackmun did not really appreciate Justice Scalia's rhetoric in many cases. But these current justices have learned to work with him. You know, Justice John Paul Stevens essentially said, you know, there's so many times when he's been over the top in his rhetoric. And I've thought it hasn't served him, Justice Stevens said, but he gets them.
Joan Biskupic, we're talking about Justice Antonin Scalia in Joan's new book. It's titled American Original. We'll take just a short break and be back with more of your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Charles Duhigg returns to talk about chemicals in our drinking water and why many of the nation's sewer systems are desperately in need of infrastructure repairs, even if it's not politically attractive.
There's not a lot of politicians who want their name on a sewer system.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And just before the break, Joan Biskupic, you were talking about Justice Scalia's relationships with his colleagues.
What I was mentioning is that Justice Stevens says, you know, he's certainly been influential. He describes him as being some of his work being constructive, but some of it not so. Remember, he was so much on the other side of him in Bush v. Gore and the Guantanamo detainees cases. But people are always intrigued by Justice Scalia's relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, quite the feminist who made her name as a women's rights advocate and came on the court in 1993. And they are best friends on the court.
Really?
And what she says is, I love Nino, but sometimes I could strangle him. And I think that embodies a lot of his colleagues' views, although hers is more intense, just because she appreciates his intellect. She appreciates his kind of similar New York manner with hers. But he's infuriating.
But there are a lot of people who ask, and they've sent us emails, does he have empathy? Is he a compassionate person?
I would say when you watch him during oral arguments and you read what he writes on the law, empathy would not be the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth word that would come to you. He is able to sort of be tough-minded, combative. I think people who know him personally, if Justice Ginsburg were sitting here, she'd say yes, in many settings he's empathetic. But that is not any kind of role that he's taken on as a jurist.
Now, there was one point you write about in the late 90s when you say Scalia felt isolated and worried about, quote, repeating himself. What does that mean?
Oh, you're referring to a wonderful personal note he wrote to Harry Blackmun at one point after so many different losses and dissents after the 95-96 term. Justice Scalia was in the dissent in a case that said that VMI, the military institute in Virginia, needed to go co-ed. He was in the dissent against a gay rights ruling in a Colorado case. He was dissent, bang, 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 several different cases. And he was writing these dissenting statements that were battle cries to fellow conservatives out there, and that were falling on deaf ears in the majority of the court, certainly, and probably the majority of the nation, although he was getting a lot of attention for them. And Justice Harry Blackmun, who had retired a few years earlier, wrote him a personal note that said, essentially, fuck up. It will get better. I hope the summer helps you feel that you're not as isolated as you certainly seem from your statements and these opinions. And Justice Scalia wrote back something to the effect of, I feel like I'm repeating myself. I don't know if it's even worthwhile anymore. Mm. And frankly, in some
what did that mean? I don't know if it's worthwhile.
Well,
it being the court,
his time as a justice, yeah, because he wasn't making headway with his
right
colleagues, and he was making headway beyond the marble wall, certainly, because these law students were gobbling up these opinions. Even liberals who didn't like his views and don't like his views today would read him, but it was frustrating for Justice Scalia, and he revealed some of that frustration in this personal note to Harry Blackmun. But I have to say, what has happened in the decade and a half since then is he's now gotten more conservative. Justices to vote with him, and he's prevailing more, writing more majority opinions.
His oral arguments, I find myself wondering whether other justices don't resent the fact that he dominates these oral arguments in such a way. I mean, the poor attorneys that are out there, you know, if I were standing there, I'd feel shrunken.
Well, what Justice Scalia says to that, and I spent a whole chapter looking at his oral argument style because it is so distinctive. He says, I would be disserving those lawyers if I didn't lay it on, if I didn't give them a chance to answer my toughest questions. I'm not there to, you know, make this a social thing. I'm not there to, you know, have the manners that maybe someone else, just Stevens, for example, always says, you know, may I ask you that question? He looks down the to both sides of himself to see if anybody else wants to ask a question. Not just a Scalia. He's not the kind of guy who raises his hand before he speaks.
All right. Let's go to Renton, Washington. Good morning, Janice. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I actually was going to talk about the recusing himself from Bush v. Gore, but that was covered with his son's involvement in the law firm. So my comment is, I resent Justice Scalia saying get over it when we're really talking about a coup d'etat by the judiciary. And Greg Palast and others have given ample evidence that the Florida vote count would really have come out with Gore for president. And my question to the author is, has Justice Scalia ever actually admitted that this was a reversal of the vote count by the United States?
No, as I said earlier, he has no regrets, and he also, what he will do is, as the caller might be aware, there have been a couple different studies that looked at what might have happened. But the truth is, we don't know with any certainty what really did happen because the vote counts were shut down. And even when various newspaper groups banded together to go back and try to count, there were still lots of problems with that because, as we all remember famously in Palm Beach County, the butterfly ballot that had some questionable results just because people didn't know who they were voting for. So I think it's impossible to know who would have really won. He, of course, will point to studies that show that it likely would have been George W. Bush rather than the reports that would have shown it likely would have been Al Gore.
But wouldn't there have been something of a different outcome if Al Gore himself had simply said, "I insist that the whole state of Florida be recounted"?
Well, what happened was they started with the lawsuit focused on certain counties,
right,
for the recounts.
Right.
And that became a bit of the issue as
and
they went along.
And that was the problem.
But the other problem is that by the time they got to the Supreme Court level, probably nothing that Al Gore was going to say in a legal manner was going to prevail.
Thanks for calling, Janice. Now to Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Hey, Justice Scalia, in his private practice, represented rich and powerful people. And I would argue that as his so-called decisions are all foregone conclusions, that no matter how eloquently he represents his viewpoints, you know, if the case is already tried in a person's mind before the judges even before the lawyers even present it, I don't think it's so much a judicial or a judge, you know, trying to weigh the merits of a case. You know, if you've already got your thumb on the scales, you're just being an advocate for the same people that you were representing as a practicing attorney. And as for Bush v. Gore, I would say that I'll get over it when Bush's victims come back to life and all the tears of the past 8 years have been uncried.
Interesting.
It is. And I have to say, it is it is noteworthy that people still feel so strongly about that decision. And he can't understand that, but it's right there. I can't go anywhere without that question being asked. And I think for a lot of good reasons. The one thing that I would mention to the caller is that several of his critics do say, look, he calls himself an originalist, but why do his opinions so neatly align with his ideology and his politics? Now, Justice Scalia will often say, well, but haven't you seen what I did in the flag burning case? Now, in 1989 and 90, I believe it was when the flag burning issue came before the Supreme Court, and he cast a vote to say that flag burning is free speech that should be protected by the Constitution. That was a very narrow 5-4 set of cases. And he says, and I voted that way even though I don't like scruffy, sandal-wearing, bearded folks who burn the flag. Those are his words. So that's kind of his defense. But the truth is that so many times his cases do align that he is open to that, the kind of criticism that the caller is referring to.
All right. Now to Elaine, who's in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi there. You're on the air. Elaine.
Did you say Elaine?
Yes.
Oh, I have to go back in history. When I was a young girl, I got a 98 on my report card in a math course. My father said to me, what happened to the other 2 points? The next year, I get 100 on my report card in a math subject, and my father says, what's the matter? The teacher was a dope.
Oh.
I have to tell you that I thought that was his way, being Jewish, of not being able to compliment me. But what I'm understanding is that my father was from Europe. He was Jewish. His father was from Italy, and I think it may have been more a cultural thing. And I have to say one more thing. Diane, I love your program and your voice.
Thank you so much. You know, I understand her points very well, don't you?
I do, and I think I opened the whole book with a line from Charles Lamb that's known to many people out there. Lawyers, I suppose, were children once. And then I referred to Justice Scalia invoking that during one of his speeches. And I think that no matter how far we are from our childhood lives on in us. And here's a man who's 73 years old, who even in conversations just within the last couple of months couldn't help but refer to his own relation with his father just how he felt that he might have let him down.
You know, you've been covering the court for quite some time, but we all have seen the historical precedents of justices who've gone before. Has there ever been anyone as outspoken and in your face on the court as Antonin Scalia?
Well, Diane, historically, yes, but people wouldn't have known it as much. Think of our times. A journalism pal of mine said he's almost like a blogger. You know, he's the kind of person who will say anything and get it out there. And I think in this day and age where he can give a speech and it can ricochet across the globe, that has both helped him and hurt him when some of his more intemperate remarks will get reported. He's sort of a justice for our time in that way, where he's larger than life, and this new media world gets his message out much more. You know, he travels on the road more than any of the other justices, in part to, as I said, to sell his own book, but also to get his message out there when his colleagues won't be heeding him all the time.
A justice for our time, but perhaps not such a healthy one?
Well, you're referring to, I presume you're not talking about his own health. You're talking about healthy for America.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, someone who is locked in a view of the Constitution from its 18th century origins, as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said to me, you know, that can't endure. The nation as a whole can't swing to one extreme or the other. And his view is extreme. Even the other conservatives on the court, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, Justice Anthony Kennedy, do not join him on some of the more controversial matters of what's going on in America.
Joan Biskupic, her new book is titled American Original. It's all about Justice Antonin Scalia. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll go now to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Chuck.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you. Listen, I had an opinion I wanted to express, but I want to try to turn it into a question if I can, so
certainly,
that the author can let me know if I'm characterizing or mischaracterizing Antonia properly. I have thought that when you talk about him being an 18th century, having an 18th century viewpoint, is he not referring to believing in three very distinct, well-defined branches, and that would Antonia, in his own mind, not like to see the legislative branch be much more active and aggressive in addressing many of these issues, and that would he not believe that the will of the people is more expressly articulated through the legislative branch, and that the judiciary should be playing a different role? Is that a proper characterization or not?
Actually, it is a good characterization of part of his thinking, because of all the justices up there, I would say he's the one who has the strictest idea of the separation of powers. He, in many cases, he has been by himself, especially in his early years before we had Justice Thomas, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Alito on, in terms of what are the distinct roles of the branches. And as I said initially, one thing that makes him believe that judges shouldn't be in the business of, you know, privacy rights, abortion rights. He'll use that phrase a lot. Judges shouldn't be in the business of blank. Is because he says any societal change or improvement should come through the legislative branch, the Democratic branch.
All right. To Rosemary in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, please.
I'm a retired trial court judge and a graduate of Notre Dame Law School, so I've been in this process with Mr. Scalia for a large part of my life. What troubles me most of all is his arrogance, and that the law particularly proclaimed by the courts, affects so many of us personally. in my time on the bench, what I found is that being in touch with the people, poverty, and believe me, the courts are about the poor of us. I don't see Justice Scalia being touched by that, by the people, and I wonder if there's any possibility or any hope that he will evolve in the court towards a more wisdom, a wiser and more compassionate approach to the people that he affects.
There's that word, compassion.
Yeah, and I think the caller has an interesting question, and I don't think she should hold her breath, to tell you the truth. I think that he really does not see his role as one to take into consideration the sorts of concerns that she raised. And I have to say, some of my more liberal professor friends had mentioned this, that he's not a great example for lower court judges in the respect that the caller raises.
And what about his relationship with the newest justice on the court?
Well, she's from the Bronx. He grew up in Queens. We've got Ruth Bader Ginsburg from Brooklyn. I think they can all really fend for themselves. And she's right in there. She is very much in there during oral arguments, giving it back to him, too.
Joan Biskupic, her new book is titled American Original, The Life and Constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Congratulations, Joan.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.